The story of the man who's healed in the fifth chapter of John is one of my favorite stories in all of the Gospels. I've spoken about it before and about how that character is one of my favorite characters in all of the Gospels because he is so human. He does everything he can possibly do to keep from taking responsibility for being well. Jesus comes, sees him there, knows that he's been sick for 38 years, and says, "Do you want to be healed?" And he never says yes. He gives all the reasons why he's not healed yet, and Jesus heals him anyway, "Take up your bed and walk." Then later, when he has the chance to do right with the religious authorities, he gives Jesus up to them and never really takes on fully the healing that Jesus has offered. I know that there are stories of miraculous physical healing. I've talked to people who have experienced that themselves, healings that are unexplainable by medical science. But when I read this particular story, I tend to read it as a metaphor, not so much of physical healing, but of choosing spiritual and psychological health. Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be mature? Do you want to be the grown-up that we were talking about last week here? Do you want to choose that health? And there are also stories, there are ways that we can choose physical health, that we can choose to do the things that will make us healthy and not do the things that will make us unhealthy, not have the hot fudge sundae after dinner necessarily, and stop smoking and get more exercise, all those kinds of things that help us to choose to be well. But the question when I read this story today is, what about the physical ailments that aren't a matter of bad choices? What about the physical illnesses that one does not bring on oneself? We deal with illnesses like that all the time. When I was a hospice chaplain for some years in Marin, I faced those kinds of illnesses all the time. Sick kids or people in the prime of life who have eaten well and not smoked and taken good care of themselves and gotten lots of exercise and have still gotten sick. So sometimes it's more complicated than just saying, "Yes, I want to be healed," and getting better physically. Sometimes it's not just something that losing a few pounds or quitting smoking can rectify. In my family, in the Haygood family, we have recently found ourselves in the middle of one of those stories of illness. And I want to talk about it a little bit today. There's a school of thought, I know, that the preacher should never talk about herself or himself. That it can be that, and I think what they're really talking about there is setting ourselves up as exemplars, which is always a very dangerous thing to do. But Barbara Brown Taylor, who's one of my favorite preaching teachers, said when the preacher tells a story from the pulpit, the purpose of that is so that the people hearing the story can say, "Oh, yes, me too." So the story that we tell should be stories about the human condition and our shared human experience. So I tell this story about my family today not because it's unique, but because it is so common. My brother Charlie is the youngest of the five of us, the five kids in my family, the youngest of my four brothers. David is the oldest, lives here in the Bay Area. Bill died of AIDS about 15 years ago. Then there's me, then there's Jim, who's 5 years younger than me, and then Charlie. Charlie's 45 years old, single, lives in downtown Los Angeles. He is healthy and fit and takes good care of his body and always has. At the end of April, he had a sinus infection that was not clearing up. They tried treating it with this and that, and various doctors. Finally, someone decided they needed a biopsy, and they found a tumor in his sinus, a very serious aggressive sarcoma. And it came completely out of the blue, from a sinus infection to life-threatening cancer in one day. So my family went into crisis management mode, which my family does really well. David was in the military. He runs everything like a military operation. So both of my brothers and their wives started working the internet, doing all the research, finding out about this extremely rare cancer, rhabdomyosarcoma. We started learning the vocabulary. We all started talking with friends who were cancer survivors themselves or had dealt with cancer in their families, finding out who we should talk to, what we needed to hear, what we didn't need to hear. Started scheduling appointments with all these different doctors, finding out who the best doctors were in the Los Angeles area and across the country. Going along with Charlie to these appointments, taking notes, asking questions. And then they also took on the task of communicating with the rest of us, with family and friends who were at a distance and couldn't be there for the daily dealing with Charlie's disease, but want to be as supportive and informed as we can. So Jim, the brother who's 5 years younger than me, started a blog, which, if you don't know the lingo, a blog is an online journal. It comes from the term web log, which was reduced to the unfortunate abbreviation of blog, with its attendant forms, blogger, blogging, and blogosphere. So Jim has entered the blogosphere with this blog about Charlie's disease. And he was going to Charlie's appointments with him daily, so there was a lot of time that Jim was spending in waiting rooms, and he thought he might as well do some writing about this experience from the caregiver's perspective. So I want to read a few excerpts from Jim's blog. It's a powerful story, and he's a wonderful writer and wonderful photographer. If you want the link to the actual thing, I will give it to you. But I read this to affirm the experience of those who deal with illness and those who care for them, who form the community of support for people who are sick. And if I may ask, and feel free not to answer, but how many here, just so we have a sense of what this community is, how many here have been treated for cancer in the past? And how many have been caregivers for people who've been treated for cancer? So this is not a unique experience. It is a common experience, and I read from Jim's blog in honor of all of you and your experiences. The diagnosis was on April 29th. The first entry into the blog was Sunday, May 9th. One foot in front of the other was the name of the entry. And these are only bits and pieces. Here is where we are right now. Charlie has been diagnosed with alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma. We've never heard of it either. This is a disease that mainly strikes children, but does occur rarely in adults of all ages. You get the idea. This is rare. Charlie was lucky in the sense that his tumor is in his sinus, so he had symptoms. Many times RMS shows up in other areas where it can go undetected. At this point, no scans have shown any spread of the cancer elsewhere. This is very good news. There is a small amount of additional info to gather. That's what he thought on May 9th, small amount of info. But so far, so good. There is a tough battle ahead, but it is not without hope. That's where we stand. Charlie is making huge adjustments to this radical change of course. His support group is doing homework, scheduling, logistics, and communication. We are all preparing for whatever comes down the pike. Many have gone before us, and we are relying on their experience. Now we'll see what is thrown at Charlie, and we will see how we can help him fight this fight. What we can guarantee is he will not fight alone. Monday, May 10th, the new normal. Today was our first day at City of Hope Hospital, where Charlie will receive his treatment, a treatment that will last most of the next year. There is a huge load of info pouring in, coming in these waves that are both hard to believe and hard to accept. These consultations with the doctors are particularly hard. Right now, Charlie is trying to maintain some equilibrium, some normalcy in the midst of what survivors call the new normal. But a sit-down with a matter-of-fact oncologist rocks all that. So we sit in these sterile examination rooms, all pretty much the same, trying to gather information and get questions answered, trying to turn those answers into some kind of picture of Charlie's future. He is ground zero for these discussions. They could not be more personal. Part of the shock of being tossed into this world is realizing that it's here all the time. We are surrounded by a constant stream of people in various states of their treatment, patients, families, medical staff, all moving through their familiar routines while we try to adjust. Where's the coffee shop? Where is radiology? Where is that nurse's desk? What building are we in? Why is this door locked? Normally, we would have driven by on the 605 on the way to somewhere else, easily forgetting all these people were here, coping, taking one step at a time. But now we're here, filling out the paperwork, looking at the scans, listening to the options, walking these halls. I can't imagine having to do this alone. The new normal. We all talk and find ways to laugh, but it's there, something new in Charlie's eyes. We love our brother, and we know that even though he is big and fit and strong, our brother is sick. Wednesday, May 12th, bedside manners. Right now, Charlie doesn't want diagnostic details. He wants to start treatment, but he doesn't really care to know his stage, his cure percentage, all that movie of the week stuff. He wants to fight with optimism, and right now feels a bunch of dire-sounding stats won't help his mood. I get that. But I want some info. I leave a message. A couple hours later at home, I get a call from the doctor's nurse. I say I want to talk to the doctor about the x-ray to see if the cancer had spread, to see what the results are. She says, oh, the x-ray was negative. I'm like, what do you mean? Why didn't anyone call us? We've been on pins and needles over here. We're in crisis. We need that information. She says, we don't call if the tests are negative. I'm thinking, and people let you get away with that? We talked for about 15 minutes, me trying to explain what you'd think would be pretty obvious, that people at this stage of treatment are like broken shells, spinning, lost, filled with unanswered questions, grabbing at anything solid, desperate for fixed points on the horizon. And they don't bother to call if the news is good, and by good, I mean cancer good. Sunday, May 16th. Charlie talked about fighting this fight, how focusing on the top of the mountain, the ultimate goal, is daunting, how just looking to the next bend in the trail, the next footstep, makes it manageable. Our friend Gus, who trains Navy SEALs, related it to his experience late on Monday of Hell Week, the tortuous week of abuse that separates Navy SEALs from almost Navy SEALs. Surf torture, this is what Gus wrote, surf torture will begin at last light. As it starts getting dark and you approach the water, the tough thing is knowing what's coming. As you link arms with your boat crew, the sustaining thing is knowing that you won't be alone. Tell Charlie we're in. Thursday, May 20th, cancer bingo. Dateline City of Hope. Back for the afternoon, ready to get moved through the system. There's a big screen on the wall filled with numbers to show whose turn it is to go in. One of the women there calls it cancer bingo. Charlie gets called in. I work on a crossword on the iPhone for a minute, and he's back, bandage on his inner elbow, and we're off. Next stop, radiology. We get checked in there by the cheeriest nurse in the world. She goes through all the usual pre-op questions and says, I looked at the info in your folder. I'll say a prayer for you. I look at Charlie and see this gesture does not have the intended effect. Whatever. Charlie heads off to get this started, and I start my wandering rounds. I walk by the valet, and a family's getting out of their car. They have that dazed look like they've just seen a ghost. I hear them saying, we need to find the guest services desk, which is where you're told to go on your first time at City of Hope. So I know they probably just had this life-changing diagnosis dropped into their home. They're in a panic. There's actually someone here more clueless than us. Tuesday, May 25th. Charlie is feeling more ready to take in the details of this process, the transition from healthy guy with your standard set of troubles to the new normal at ground zero is tough. But he's now wanting more info, more control, more clarity that he has the final vote. He's calling Dr. C today to let him know how things will be. We have not ruled out surgery, but it will happen because Charlie chooses it, not because Dr. C does. Wednesday, May 26th. What an amazing place to find ourselves, to be eager for these people to start poisoning Charlie. It makes no sense, but that's where we are. sitting here in Duarte, California, passing all the families in the halls racked with similar choices, accepting the new normal, looking forward to the day Charlie's tests come up clean, thinking negative. I think of a prayer Chandler passed on to me, his way of focusing his healing in Charlie's direction. It's a Quaker prayer said when parting from one another. They say, "I'll be holding you in the light." Despite all that is happening, we are still grateful, proud, honored to be here, knowing that there are so many out there holding Charlie, holding all of us in the light. Friday, May 28th, chemo begins. This is happening now. It's real. These chemicals are sliding through these tubes and into his body. Chemicals selected for their ability to seek out particularly active cell growth, which is how they identify the enemy, and kill it. As smart as cancer is, as inventive, it does not know this army is coming. I pray it's not up to the fight. And this is one of his most recent posts, just from a couple days ago. I was thinking about what comes next, how I want the drugs to work, to rain down on the tumor in epic cinematic fashion, apocalypse now. I want the tumor terminated with extreme prejudice. I want the drugs to go all Pulp Fiction, striking down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brother. That's what I want, to get medieval on this thing, Old Testament. Chandler sent me a passage from Exodus a while back. It stuck in my head because it captured something metaphorical about battle and strength and dedication and service. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel at Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, "Choose for us men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat upon it. And Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and one and the other on the other side, so his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua slew Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then I took the liberty of changing the names in that passage, with apologies to the Deuteronomist. Then came cancer and fought with life at City of Hope. And Charlie said to chemo, "Choose for us men and go out, fight with cancer. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of the immune system in my hand." So chemo did as Charlie told him and fought with cancer. And Charlie, his family, and friends went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Charlie held up his hand, life prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, cancer prevailed. But Charlie's hands grew weary. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat upon it. And his family and friends held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side, so his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And chemo mowed down cancer and his tumors with the edge of the sword. It's that chemo time again, time for another tour of duty, time to link arms, boots on, wheels up, family and friends holding Charlie in the light, one on one side and the other on the other side, so his hands are steady until the going down of the sun. Old Testament. My friend Badana sent a note once saying that this fight is 2 steps strength, 4 steps fury. That sounds right. The edge of the sword. That's what I'm talking about. A few final comments. First, on that Exodus passage, it's very strange for me to be drawn to these passages with metaphors of violence and images of battle. But sometimes those are necessary. I'm not saying that we slay those who don't agree with us politically or religiously, but that we find a support team in a struggle that's literally life over death. We have Team Charlie working on this struggle now. We even have the dog tags. It says, "Link Arms 2010, tell Charlie we're in." And in John 5, Every time I read a passage, a story that I love, a familiar story, there's always something new that comes out of it for me, depending on the circumstances in my own life. And in this story, where I've always felt so drawn to the denial of the unwillingness to be healthy of the man in the story, this time the line that leapt out at me was when Jesus says, "Do you want to be healed?" And he says, "I have no one to lower me into the pool when the water is stirred." And that should never be the case. That's the role that the church can play. To be family for those who don't have family, and to be family for those whose family members need to support themselves. And we have that here, the helping hands that Bill helps to coordinate, this email list of people who can bring a meal or give a ride to the doctor. And if you want to be on that list, make a note of that on a white card. We have the deacons program that's in the process of being put together. I had hoped to have that completed before I go, but we're close, and I know others will carry it forward. We have prayer groups, formal and informal, in this church who hold one another in prayer when we know the things that people are going through, and even when we don't. And we have sisters and brothers. In my family, it's all about sisters and brothers. And in this church, it's all about sisters and brothers. Caring for one another and seeing to it that no one ever goes through something like this alone. That no one, when offered healing, says, "But I have no one to lower me into the pool." And there's one other story that comes to my mind as I think about this. And the caregivers and their ferocity in seeing to it that the one they love gets the care that they need and deserve. There's the story of the paralytic who can't get to Jesus for healing because of the crowd that has surrounded him. And four of his friends put him on a pallet and climb up on top of the roof of the building, of the house that Jesus is in, and tear the roof tiles off, tear a hole in the roof so that they can lower their friend down so that he can get the healing that he needs. I love the tenacity of those friends. I think the healing that Jesus offers is out of respect in some degree for the tenacity of those friends. And when I think of the guy in John 5 there by the pool at the Sheep's Gate with no one to be with him, I wonder if he had family and friends around him. If then, when Jesus approached him and said, "Do you want to be healed?" he would have had the strength and the support to say yes to healing and all that health implies. That's what we're here for as a church and as a family, to help each other to have the strength to say yes. Amen.